Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Today and for the next 2 days, families of the victims of the 2018 campfire will tell their stories in court. Yesterday, the CEO and president of PG&E, Bill Johnson, said the words, "Guilty, Your Honor," more than 80 times in responding to 84 counts of involuntary manslaughter and one felony count of illegally setting a fire. The campfire destroyed the towns of Paradise, Concow, and much of Megalia, and a lot of the surrounding area in Butte County. More than $16.5 billion in damages came from that wildfire. Casey Gibbs is a former substitute teacher and an Air Force veteran. He lived in Paradise at the time of the fire, and he's on the phone with us from Yuba City, where he lives now. Hi, Casey. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me on.
How closely are you following these court proceedings this week?
Well, I, of course, immediately read the guilty plea. I think it's strange for me, as it is for everyone else, to see somebody confess to 84 counts of killing people, really. So I think for anybody that's incredible news, and I think it speaks to a lot of what's happening, what I'd like to see happening, and that is that people are reconsidering this idea of deregulation is so great and is a great idea. When regulation is really what protects, you know, the vulnerable. And so, for me, I hope that people think about that more.
Where were you on November 8th, 2018? Will you tell me a little bit of your experience that day and then what happened afterward?
As a matter of fact, that day I had, I was about to accept a job offer down at Paradise Elementary, which everyone knows, or most people know, burned to the ground. And I'd gone outside because the winds had been so high that I actually wasn't really thinking about fires. I was thinking about, I just raked and cleaned everything. So I went outside, I opened the garage door, and when I looked out, I saw smoke, very heavy smoke, that seems, you know, not 50 feet over the roof of the house. It seemed very close. And so I immediately, I was still in my pajamas, and I immediately just grabbed my sprinkler and a ladder and threw my sprinkler on the roof, and then went downstairs to listen to see if I could hear anything on the scanner. To see if I could find out, you know, if there was a fire close by and whether we needed to be worried. And when I listened, they all said, "Hey, it's down in Polgett's, 20 miles away." And I thought, that is bizarre, because it looks like it's right here. About that time, my neighbor across the street, we were a close-knit community, so he saw me on the roof, and he ran across. He said, "Hey, I'm listening on mine, and it looks like there's two ignition points. So there's a fire close by. You might want to start getting your stuff packed and get ready to get out of here." And so I, you know, at that point I said, "Yeah, let's do that." I grabbed my wife and said, "Hey, pack up Allie's stuff. Let's." So she started packing all my daughter, who was two's, clothes, and I jumped into the shower. I hadn't showered yet, and I was getting out of the shower when a neighbor from down the street pulled up, and said, "Hey, the street's on fire. You need to evacuate now." So I quickly grabbed some clothes, and we jumped in the car. My neighbors on both sides, we all knew each other, and he said, "Hey, as I was getting out, he said, "Hey, I'm gonna just make sure that these folks are are getting out and are okay, go ahead and get your family out of here. And so we knew we couldn't go back down. At that point, we knew we couldn't go down what was Skyway because it was completely blocked.
Right.
So we tried to take back roads, and it still took us 4 hours. We ended up going what is basically north towards Lake Amador. Mm. And through some backwoods, but it was definitely I will say that we never saw flames. Of course, my daughter was scared because it was a scary time. I mean, there was certainly smoke in the air, and there was people that it seemed to have lost all their mind. And there was in that area up above Magalia, there was no law enforcement or any kind of regulatory presence. So people were driving the wrong side of the road to get out on a very windy road. People had, and really the 4 hours took that long because people had blocked the road entirely to get gas at the gas stations, which seems bizarre to me now, seemed bizarre to me then. I had no idea why the roads were so congested, but it was people trying to get gas.
Hmm. Casey, what do you think your family lost that day, and what do you feel like you personally lost in this tragedy?
Well, for us, I think my daughter carries around her backpack. When we go to grocery stores, she takes her toys with her. She's so afraid that her house is going to burn again that she takes everything with her. Everywhere she tries to take all of her toys with her. So I think that sort of peace and and the routine that we try to maintain was definitely affected, and it's very hard it's been hard to get her to overcome that, to say, okay, you can take in one toy, instead of, I can't tell you how many backpacks she's broken because she tries to pack them so full of all of her toys. And to me, it all goes back to that day of her trying frantically to grab all of her stuff and knowing that, there's a probability that she's never going to see any of her things again. For us, both my wife and I have lost parents and grandparents, and we had a lot of heirlooms and things that we can't replace. And so those things are tangible, and there just isn't. You can't financially put a cost on those things. Those are things that are just lost, but they're just things. It's the to me, what's more telling or more heartbreaking is really the loss of community, the loss of being able to go to the grocery store and hand your friends, because they all work there, your daughter while you shop because they want to play with her. There's a whole loss there that doesn't get. I think that people don't realize because it was a small community. And
let me clarify, Casey. Did you lose family members in the wildfire?
No, thank goodness. And really, I'll tell you that we feel really, really, really lucky. So I don't want to take away from those that did lose someone that they loved. We did not.
And what about your house? What happened to your home?
Our home was completely destroyed. There was nothing left. It so, burned so hot. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. It burned. Go ahead.
Well, it burned so hot that we had hopes that we could go up and maybe find coin collections and things like that were heirlooms and But even that, everything to the windows was melted. There was literally nothing that survived. Nothing. It wasn't like a flood. Nothing survived.
I think those moments and some of the images that you're describing, your daughter and her backpack, those are the places where every one of us can connect with the pain through whatever frame of experience we have in our lives, though nothing, as you said, can compare to that actual experience. And yet some people stayed. Casey, some went back in when it was safe and they have begun to rebuild. Is this something you and your wife considered?
We did consider it, but it's you know, we've gone up because we've gone up to the property. We've kept the property because we hoped. We really hoped, and we still have one neighbor that whose house somehow miraculously our next door neighbor's home was fine. It didn't burn, so we still had them there. But you know, it's not the same. There's not the jobs, that the schools have burned, so I can't get work up there as I'm there's, you know, the stores aren't the same, the people that work there, the people that you knew, it's hard to think I'm going to walk down this pathway that I used to wave to the and talk and chat with the old widow that was very sweet and kind. But I feel guilty because I didn't know that nobody told her. Nobody told her there was a fire coming, and she was lost. And so you live with sort of, I don't want to say guilt, but sort of a wish that you could go back and make sure that everybody got out, that things happened the right way. You know, that things happened better. I don't know. I'll say that it's I think that losing your house and losing your belongings is a far cry from losing people that you love. So when I see things like when I see that 84 people that I was more that we were so much more lucky than 84 of my fellow neighbors, you know, how do you feel anything but grateful?
Casey, you're living now in Yuba City, and we're also in the midst of a pandemic. Schools have been closed. What is your job situation, and has this been, in some ways, one crisis on top of another for your family?
It absolutely has. I can't even describe to you how frustrating the timing seems to be. We felt like my daughter, who's now four and was in preschool and was really, sort of a social butterfly. She loves it. And to say, okay, well, you know, there's no more gymnastics, there's no more ballet, there's no more this, you're stuck in your house. And those were things that we were using to sort of get her over the loss of her home. So on that end, as a parent, I will say, as a parent, it was very difficult. As far as jobs go, well, yeah, I was trying to make connections because I was graduating this year as a school psychologist. So part of being a substitute teacher was, hey, I'm going to make connections with the right folks. I'm going to get all my job lined up with, you know, some of the school districts. But you know, the pandemic happened, right, and so now even subbing is no more. So as far as work wise, it compounded the problem. So it made it worse. But, you know, we're getting by and we're happy and everything's okay. I don't think that I wish that no one had to go through this.
I appreciate that you've been willing to go back in time. It's not easy to relive an experience when, as you say, you're looking forward and you're trying to keep your life happy. So I appreciate that you've recalled your memories and brought us up to speed on your life. And we wish you all the continued important steps forward that a person and a family needs in life, Casey.
Thank you for having me on, Beth.
That's Casey Gibbs. He is a substitute teacher. He lived in the Megalia Paradise area of Butte County, now living in Yuba City. We are talking about the 2018 campfire, and we're going to play a little bit of the PG&E CEO Bill Johnson's testimony from yesterday's court hearing. Here it is as he said it.
I'm here today on behalf of the 23,000 men and women of PG&E to take responsibility for the fire that killed the people whose pictures we just saw as we went through the counts. And I've heard the pain and anguish of many of the victims as I've visited Paradise, as they've described the loss they continue to endure and the wounds that can never really heal. And no words from me can ever reduce the magnitude of that devastation or do anything to repair the damage, but I hope, and I sincerely hope, that the actions we're taking today will help bring some measure of peace. Our equipment started that fire, destroyed the towns of Paradise, Concow, severely burned Megalia, other parts of Butte County, took the lives of 85 people. Thousands of people lost their homes and businesses, forced to evacuate under horrific circumstances. I wish there was some way to take back what happened or to take away the impact, the pain that these people have suffered, but I know that can't be done.
Family members of victims watched on YouTube. The judge, Michael Deems, set aside time for families to make statements beginning today. On the phone now is Robert Weisberg. He is law professor at Stanford Law School and co-director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center. Professor Weisberg, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Will you give me your reaction to how CEO Bill Johnson has been navigating PG&E's role in the fire leading up to yesterday and then particularly yesterday?
Well, he's probably made the best he can of a bad situation. And by the way, one he came into very late in the process. PG&E is now the most scrutinized corporation in America in some ways. And it has undergone every conceivable form of legal liability. And the criminal part of it, in some ways, turns out to be more symbolic than the rest. You can't put a corporation in prison. You can punish it if what it has done collectively constitutes a crime, and that seems to have been conceded here. But what does punishment mean? It almost always means taking lots of its money. In theory, that money being a fine could go to government, in this case the state government or the county government. But, of course, the main concern is that it go to victims. Now, of course, there were also civil suits, which any individual victim can bring, and that can result in damages. But in addition, not only is PG&E a heavily regulated company, but it's now in bankruptcy. So it has creditors who are taking assets from it or trying to take assets from it. And it's going through bankruptcy and it'll get reconstituted in some way. So another way to look at it is another form of punishment is losing control of its own operations and management by yielding them to court officials, whether it's bankruptcy officials or possibly even the sentencing judge in the criminal case. So it's all overdetermined. The assets of PG&E are going to be divided up, but chances are there will be something called PG&E that will continue if the company exits Chapter 11. The thing is, PG&E is technically a criminal, yes, that has pleaded guilty to a horrendous number of homicides, but it's also just an extremely abstract entity. And therefore, this case just underscores just the paradox of criminally punishing a so-called person, I'm putting the term in quotes, who is really a corporation.
Hmm. And no executives individually will be going to prison. Is this the first, though, for an American company to be charged with and then plead guilty to homicide?
It's happened in a few other cases. It's very, very rare. Certainly nothing like this number. There have certainly been prosecutions that haven't ended up in convictions. In fact, it goes back, 40 years or so to an infamous event involving a car called the Ford Pinto. This is one of the consumer scandals that made Ralph Nader famous. And the Ford Motor Company was actually criminally prosecuted in a state court in Indiana for involuntary manslaughter, pretty much the same charge that PG&E is facing here. That case ended in an acquittal. This is, again, certainly the largest. But, again, one of the ironies here is that given all the civil suits, the earlier criminal case against PG&E, which was successful, that was a federal case, not brought under state homicide law, but under brought because of violation of federal regulations of pipeline safety rules, and those violations were deemed criminal and led to huge fines. And if you add the bankruptcy, by the time we get to this guilty plea, there isn't much left of PG&E in a way. There's just something kind of ironic about characterizing it as, you know, the perpetrator of 84 homicides. It sounds very lurid. It sounds like it's a mass murder. It's not a murder. It's a manslaughter or almost a serial killing. But the fact is, it's just the last sort of sad legal, box to be checked in the virtual demise of PG&E as it had existed.
I'm going to clarify. Sometimes we see the number 84 and then 85. There were 84 lives lost in the fire, and then subsequently there was a suicide. So that's why we sometimes see the number 85. And since we're going to talk about numbers, yes, a $3.5 million fine as part of this plea. The company will pay $13.5 billion to people who lost homes and businesses. It will also pay $500,000 to Butte County for the cost of the investigation. And then separately, it's been fined $2 billion. So there's much more money other than that original just $3.5 million figure. But all that money said, can you talk about this small piece of equipment, this sea hook that was broken, that was the key moment that all of this hinges around?
Well, I'm no engineer, but obviously some kind of causation was established. It would have to be if it's a homicide case, just as it would be if it were a civil wrongful death case, which it is as well. It has to be shown that the defendant caused the death. Homicide law is in some ways extremely simple in the abstract. The crime of homicide is causing a death with some kind of culpable mental state, and then whether it's a low-level manslaughter or a high-level murder is a function of what the mental state is. And then we get into this question of what is the mental state of the corporation. And as pleaded here, it's basically criminal negligence. Now, why has no individual been criminally convicted? Well, presumably because you can't find the moment, or at least the prosecutors can't find the moment when an individual was in a position to avoid or prevent the disaster, this particular device from malfunctioning, where you could say that person, a reasonable official or a reasonable employee in that situation would have realized the necessity to do that. So the culpable negligence of the corporation is itself a kind of abstraction. It's imputing all kinds of mistakes and lumping them together into a kind of mega mistake made by the corporation. But with respect to the suicide, were this an individual criminal case, or were that the only death, there might have been what criminal law people would call an old-fashioned question of causation. When you have a suicide, There's always the argument that although the defendant who created some kind of condition that put the person into distress, you know, merit some kind of punishment, it was still some kind of voluntary choice on the part of the defendant. I'm certainly not saying that here. I don't know anything about the individual here, and I'm just making a kind of legalistic point. But in this case, I'm not really sure it matters whether you call it 84 or 85. Obviously, it matters tremendously to the victim and the victim's family.
Yes.
Legally, you know, they could have pleaded guilty to 5. They could have pleaded guilty to 500 deaths. It all would have come to the same thing, which is a restricted amount of fine money that can be paid under California law, the $3.5 million, but then all kinds of other money paid out in civil suits, or under federal law. And so, again, it's a question of, you know, what's left of PG&E. Answer, not much, except a name and a structure, which will come out of Chapter 11, presumably with new leadership and new regulations. So it's a something of an ill fit, as it always is, between criminal law and a corporate defendant. And it's exacerbated, that ill fit is exacerbated when it's a homicide case. People say, why wasn't this a first-degree murder case? Why shouldn't there be the death penalty? And then the question is, what does that mean in the case of a corporation?
Hmm. One last point I'd like you to respond to, Professor Weisberg, and that is that the CEO, Bill Johnson, had previously announced that he's going to retire on June 30th. And as you said, he came in somewhat late to all of this, but he's been the public face and the public voice of the apology, the taking of responsibility, the visiting Paradise, talking with the families. And we are in such a highly charged time in our country where an apology, a sense of responsibility, an effort at retribution, an expression of remorse are some of the most important actions that we can lift up right now. So in terms of the law and moving forward, how weighty is the way that Bill Johnson, on behalf of PG&E, has been conducting this?
Compared to what you might expect and sometimes see of corporate executives, I think he's, you know, I think he's been impressive and effective. Because even when there is an apology from a corporation, it's often highly rhetorical, highly cliched, and highly artificial. It just goes to the question of the now leadership of PG&E. Nobody who takes this job is going to say, yes, well, PG&E has been defamed, and, you know, I'm going to stand for the values of PG&E. Another way to look at it is, it, in theory, would lie within the power of the court, certainly the federal court, to put PG&E into a receivership. That happens with companies sometimes. It happens with public agencies. You may be aware that the entire healthcare system of the California prison system is actually under federal court receivership. Here, whoever becomes the private sector CEO of PG&E after Mr. Johnson is in effect, not in law, but in effect, a kind of court-ordered receiver, because whoever takes it over is going to take it in a situation where the new CEO would acknowledge, okay, we did terrible things, we're trying to start all over, we're trying to do the right thing. So in that sense, I think it's about effective an expression for Mr. Johnson as he could possibly get. But I also want to emphasize that this is a really unusual situation, because PG&E, it was A, a regulated company in the most, one of the most regulated of industries, and B, it's being picked apart for lots of other reasons anyway. So whether this signals some kind of new attitude that we might see from corporations for corporate malfeasance in other contexts, too soon to tell.
Thank you so much for your time and the conversation. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That is Robert Weisberg. He's professor of law at Stanford Law School and the co-director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center. I do want to mention that there is a much anticipated documentary that screened and was highly received at Sundance Film Festival. It has been made by filmmaker Ron Howard with National Geographic. It's titled Rebuilding Paradise. There have been small screenings of it, private screenings, but watch for it. It will be released soon. And again, the court proceedings continue today with statements from victims' families. You can find coverage of the campfire that goes back to November of 2018. Go to our website, capradio.org, and just search campfire. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.